You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast, we're going to be talking about homestead water and some different options that people have when they're trying to take care of this essential element of any homestead or any rural property or off-grid property. I mean, this is like the number one priority, especially if you're in an arid environment or if you're in an environment, say, with less than average rainfall per year. For example, for us, we get about 30 inches of rain per year, which is decent. It's plenty, but it is lower than the average in the United States. We do get plenty of snowfall as well, but we have some other challenges for us. So, for example, we live on a slope, and a lot of the time the water just tends to run off. So we're going to talk about those things: conservation, hydrating the soil, developing springs and wells, and rainwater collection. But first, I want to get into our worldview segment for today. And this one is a very important aspect or topic, I should say. It comes from AP News. And it was from about a week ago, I guess. And it's in Utah, and it's about an anti-discrimination law that was just passed that provided some protections for the LGBT community. What's interesting about this is that these protections were put in place via the 2015 legislative session that won, you know, certain protections and rights that they wanted, and they've been lobbying for some time. But they're not happy with it. It doesn't go far enough. And it's important that we understand this because they're not ever going to be happy with it. They're going to want more and more and more. And this is important for us to understand because in this case, this legislation was actually backed by the Mormon Church, which normally recognizes traditional marriage, etc., and does not embrace homosexuality, etc. Okay, but they backed this, and I think why they backed it is because there were certain exemptions, if you will. So, for example, BYU was given an exemption. You know, the church itself was given an exemption. So the legislation itself. Let me read here for you. Let's see. So gay rights groups pushed for an anti-discrimination law and they finally succeeded. Okay. The law makes it illegal to base employment and housing decisions on sexual orientation or gender identity. So in other words, if you own a home, you're renting that home out, and if a homosexual couple comes to you and says, "Hey, we want to rent this home," you cannot deny them based on that sexual orientation. So even if you're like, "No, I don't, you know, this," for whatever reason, you have a conviction in this area, you don't want a homosexual couple renting your home, you don't have that choice here. Okay, so that's essentially kind of the bigger component of this legislation. But the religious organizations and their affiliates, schools, hospitals, etc., exempted themselves. Okay, we've seen this in other areas as well, where, say, pastors will say, "Well, you know, we have the right to say what we want, to speak truth based on scriptures, etc., but not protecting, say, for example, cake baking businesses." All right, we've seen this before. So so I'm not picking on the Mormon Church here at all, but in my mind, this is a compromise. And we've seen evangelical organizations, pastors, compromise as well. And what they're saying, what they're trying to do here, is appease the LGBT community. And they're saying, "Okay, yeah, we won't discriminate based on these things. Accept us. Accept, you know, accept the our church except our distinctly Christian or Mormon organization. Okay, that's what's going on here, and what it is compromise. And you see here, in fact, there's a good quote here, and this is by, doesn't matter who, a homosexual that obviously supports this law, but he says it felt just like scraps, that we were so desperate for any kind of legal protection that we will just take anything. In other words, it doesn't go far enough. He wasn't happy with this. He wanted to impose this also on BYU, also on the distinctly religious hospital, the church, etc. Okay, that's what's important for us to understand, and hence why we cannot compromise in this area, and we cannot establish exemptions. You know, it's, in my opinion, cowardly for any Christian organization or Mormon organization to say, okay, yeah, we'll support this, but not for our church, but not for our school, not for our hospital. Yes, you, the individual business owner, you, the individual who's renting out a home, you have to comply with this. That's fine, just not us. Okay, that's cowardly. And so the lesson learned here for the Christian is we cannot compromise in any of these areas. And this is going to become more and more crucial, especially with the Supreme Court getting ready to rule on this area of same-sex marriage. If they make essentially same-sex marriage legal throughout the 50 states, we can expect a landslide of legislation that will, these quote-unquote anti-discrimination laws will be coming in a flood. And what you're going to see is organizations compromising left and right, saying, okay, yes, but accept us, you know, accept our church, accept our hospital, accept our school. Okay, that's not good enough, right? And we can't compromise in any of those areas. We have to be subject to our conscience based on the scriptures. Okay, that's the important point here. We should not accept compromise. And if our pastors are saying, are talking about religious liberty and how, you know, no, we're going to get, you know, for the church, we'll have this exemption, or the chaplaincy will have this exemption. We should be holding them accountable. We should be calling them out. Pastors, chaplains, call them out. Leaders of Christian schools, etc., saying, why just you? Why shouldn't anyone have, you know, that's conscience believes that this is wrong, be, you know, required to do these things, to engage in these quote unquote anti-discrimination laws? You know, should an individual who has a Christian conviction based on the Holy Scriptures be required to, say, rent their house to a couple, a same-sex couple? Well, no, they shouldn't. They should not have to do that based on conscience. So this is going to be important to watch, and I'll keep an eye on it, and it's important that we stand firm. Just like Martin Luther, who stood before the Pope at the Diet of Worms in the 1500s, during the Protestant Reformation, who, by the way, the Pope was essentially the government, okay? Even the governments of that time were subject to the rule of the Pope in many ways. So Luther standing there famously, and he says, quote, "I cannot and will not recant anything, for to go against conscience is neither right nor safe. Here I stand, I can do no other. So help me God. Amen." Unquote. Okay, so just like Luther stood up against the state, the authority of the time, he stood on those principles and what he was talking about is he would not recant the scriptures. He would not sit there and say, no, I'll put the authority in the church as opposed to authority in the scriptures. Hence, we have sola scriptura, scripture alone. Okay, so this is all very important as Christians to be watching, to be aware of, and to stand on that truth. So we must and should not recant of anything that we find as our presupposition as found in the Bible. On to our main topic, which is homestead water. We briefly talked about this in the introduction. Again, water is the most important aspect of finding property, in my opinion. I mean, there are some other very important aspects, like the general location and all of that. But beyond that, once you find, say, an acceptable location overall, water is up there on top. Water access. I mean, if you can't even access the property, then it's kind of pointless. Then I go back to that location. It's no good. But water itself is super important, especially for those that are homesteading. You're doing some farmsteading. You know, you're raising a lot of animals and crops, etc. You're trying to feed yourself. I mean, this becomes crucial. If you're off-grid, if you're rural, you can't just depend on the city or the county to provide your water. You know, we get very complacent because you can sit in suburbia, and even if the power goes out, you still have water, you know, in most cases, as they'll run generators upstream, and in most cases, you'll still have water. You're rural. You're on a well with septic, you'll lose power, you'll lose water immediately. Okay, so this is a crucial aspect of the homesteading life, and that's kind of what we're going to concentrate on today. It's not so much the survival aspect. It's basic preparedness, but it's preparedness that any and all homesteaders should engage in. When it comes to water. So we're going to hit some different aspects of water to include conservation and ways to store water. So storing water, not only in, you know, for emergency water in the home, you know, the whole 1 gallon per day per person, but storing water in the soil. So we're going to talk about some techniques to be able to do that, because that's probably the best place to do it when it comes to, you know, growing food and that kind of thing. But we're going to talk briefly about springs and wells and rainwater collection. And although I'm not an expert in those areas, I've done quite a bit of study, and I can point you to some resources to get those specifics that you're looking for. But I have gained enough knowledge in this area to know, to have a good plan to put in place redundant systems in order to ensure water self-sufficiency. Okay, call it that, because that's important. When you're rural, you don't have the government's not going to come to your aid. They're not going to come with a water truck and fill up your tanks. Okay, we shouldn't want that anyway. So what I want to start with, though, is conservation, because just like energy, it's easier to use less than produce more yourself. Okay, I'm not talking about tapping into the grid and just using more energy and then therefore paying more money. If you're trying to create your own energy, it's much easier to use less than produce more. Okay, and same thing with water. We should look to conserve water, not waste it. Use it, of course, but not waste it. So these are some different ways of conserving water. And then I'll talk to you some about some of the things that we are doing presently to conserve water. It's not that we don't have a good well. We do. We have a well, and we have a backup source of running it, and we have redundant water systems, and we have a year-round stream, etc. But You can't have enough redundant water systems, in my opinion. Okay, if we did have to resort to our stream, let's say we had an extended power outage, it would be hard, because our stream is not 50 feet away from our house. It's it's a little ways away from our house. Okay, so we would have to transport that water. Could we do it? Absolutely, we could. It would just be hard. All right, so we're going to talk about conservation first of water, both in the home and then on the homestead. So, and this is, like I said, particularly important for those that are homesteading / farmsteading. We personally have, I say approximately because the number changes from week to week based on processing animals, etc. As we have approximately 80 animals at any given time. So we have a lot of animals to make sure they have clean, fresh water. And of course, our family needs clean, fresh water. So one of the first things you can do is very, very simply check your system for leaks. Okay, just a dripping faucet can waste tens of gallons a day. Okay, never mind larger leaks that maybe you can't see. That could be hundreds of gallons a day. That would just be terrible and put a lot of pressure on, say, a well. Another aspect that's very simple is not using the toilet as, say, a waste basket. You blow your nose, you throw it in the toilet and flush it. The average toilet in America, this ranges all the way down to your really low flow, less than 2 gallons per minute, all the way up to 7 gallons per minute for some older models. Okay, the average is probably 3 to 5 gallons. I mean, not per minute, per flush. This is an immense amount of water. Now, I want you to just think about this for a minute. Now, we have, depending on the time, anywhere from, at a minimum, 8 people in the house to more, okay, with visitors or people that are coming to stay with us for a period of time. So we could have more than 10, okay, and that happens quite often. So we're going to use the round number of 10 just to make it simple. If everybody, and let's just say we have the average, because we do, we have kind of older models and we're working on slowly changing this over. And we are implementing techniques to lower this number, but I'm going to talk through this. 10, just call it 10 people in the house. If every person flushes the toilet 5 times per day, which is not unreasonable at all, that is 50 flushes per day. 50 flushes per day, and let's call it 5 gallons per flush. That's 250 gallons a day just flushing the toilet. You haven't turned on the sink at all to wash your hands, to brush your teeth, to drink water, to cook, etc., to shower, all of that. So you can quickly see how that adds up. Not only that, is that all of that pressure that's put on your septic system. So when you have large numbers of people, it's especially important, because you could overload the system. It could require that you have to pump your septic multiple times per year. Okay, so there's a lot of considerations here. So conservation is vitally important. Okay, so on to something that we do. We don't flush the toilet every single time. We just don't. All right. We basically have come to a point where we 2 goes per flush at least. Okay. No, we don't like leave it all day long or things like that. So we've implemented a very simple plan in the family to probably reduce our flushes by 40%. Okay. That's important. That's important. And in fact, I would say in half, because there's some other things we do. Like the men go outside during the day. If you're outside, you don't come in to go to the bathroom. That's ridiculous. We live in the middle of a forest. And by the way, urine is sterile for a healthy person and is simply a nitrogen fertilizer. So it's great. So utilize it as a resource. We don't do that. And it's silly not to. Other things that you can do to conserve water. In the kitchen, what my wife has instituted is that we basically, there's a small basin that we fill with water, And that's the, we don't just turn the faucet on every time we need to rinse something, scrub it down, and everything like that. There, it goes in, there's a small basin, a wash basin, and that may get changed out 2 or 3 times a day. Okay, but in that, over the course of a day, there's so much water is saved by simply doing that. That one thing is a huge water saver. Because, again, remember, 10 people in the house, that's a lot of cooking. That's a lot of, you know, rinsing and washing. Okay, and instead of what most people do is just turn on the faucet and rinse and wash as you go, we're probably using a third or a quarter of the water that we would use. Okay, some other things. Water-saving shower heads, low-flow faucet. This is a good, very good idea. Now, think about this for a minute. Okay, on a shower, the average person takes, and I don't want to make assumptions here, but let's, there's the 5-minute shower and there's the 10-minute shower. Okay, and then, of course, we have those that probably take 20-minute showers or whatever. But the length of your of shower is important to understand. All right, we have to shorten that, and that's an important point of that. I mean, if you're taking more than a 5-minute shower, you're just wasting water. You really are. So let's think about this for one sec. Shower. All right, so the average shower in America, let's just call it 5 minutes. Okay. Well, a 5-minute shower in the average shower head is going to use 40 gallons of water. 40 gallons of water. Okay, so a 10-minute shower would be 80 gallons. That's a lot of water for one shower. Never mind the 20-minute shower that some people take. So that would be 160 gallons of water right there. I mean, so you can see how quickly this adds up now. 10 people in the house. Okay. We don't shower every day. We just don't. All right. That a lot of people think, oh, that's disgusting. You know what? That most people on this planet don't shower every day. Most people throughout human history did not shower every day. So unfortunately, we've gotten to this cultural mindset that we, to be hygienic or clean, you have to shower every day. It's a ridiculous notion. Okay, so how often do we shower? Well, again, it depends on what we're doing for work, but it could be closer to 3 times per week per person. That's still 30 showers a week if you're thinking about 10 people. Okay, 30 showers a week. Call it, even if we're, you know, say we're being a little bit careful, 40 gallons per shower. So 40 gallons times 30, that's 1,200 gallons of water a week. Okay. I think that's pretty reasonable for that amount of people. But again, there's some pressure there that's put on the septic and the well. And all that. What else can we do? Well, here's something that's a little bit related to energy, but it's important for water as well. And that's the idea of getting hot water going, you know, whether it's in a shower or in a sink to wash your hands. There's a couple things you can do here. You can insulate your water pipes to get hot water to you faster. Okay, so, or maybe it stays warmer longer. You can do recirculating pumps that you'd have to do an energy audit here. But in the end, I think that the using less water and, you know, the increased energy amount from a recirculating pump probably evens itself out, but then you have that water savings. Okay, so I'd say that would be a good thing. There's the tankless water heaters, etc. What I'm getting at here is the fact that you don't have to run the water so long before you get hot water. If you're getting hot water almost right away, you're using less water. Okay. And honestly, I think that's more important than any tiny bump in energy. right? Because the water is more important than energy. Same thing with things like, you know, have you ever noticed people being in the military? I noticed this a lot. When people brush their teeth, what do? They turn the water on and just leave it running the whole time. Why? There's absolutely no, I mean, this is just a complete waste of water. These are people that are just used to turning on that faucet and getting water no matter what, you know, endless amounts of water. Okay, so that's a simple thing. Same thing with shaving, you know, all these things. You don't need to continue to run the sink. And you know, when I would deploy on ship, you're taking a shower. You run the water. You turn the water off. You lather up. You turn the water back on. You rinse off. You turn the water off. You know, you go back and forth. Call it a Navy shower. Because obviously it's harder to create fresh water on a ship when you have that many people. And so you have to do desalinization. It takes a lot of energy to do desalinization. And therefore, you know, there's a lot of conservation that happens on ship, which is a good thing. You could do that same thing in your home if you were, say, very concerned, or even if you're off-grid water, maybe you're... I know people who they collect rainwater. That's their method of water. That's how they get water, all of it. Okay, so I mean that would make complete sense for them, and I'm going to talk about that here in a little bit. Washing clothes, and again, I'm going to stick to water here, not energy so much. But the different cycles on a washer. Making sure that you're using the right cycle. I mean, you need to you know, do the heavy duty cycle that rinses and fills and rinses and fills, as opposed to say a normal cycle. Okay, so I mean, obviously you want to get that stuff clean, but if you don't need to do the heavy duty cycles, then don't do it. It's important. All right, as far as now I want to move to some aspects about outside as far as just conservation. All right, when people look at ornamental plants, lawns, shrubs, etc., especially on a homestead, I mean, you know, you see some incredible effort put into lawns in suburbia and shrubs and plants, and they look beautiful. But an absolute obscene amount of water is used in most cases, especially if you're in a place like Southern California. I'm sorry, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to have these just water-hungry landscapes, especially if they're not productive. I mean, what's the point? Just looks. I mean, that's the point. So thinking through that, so planting drought-resistant lawns, shrubs, plants for ornamentals, if you're going to do that, okay, that's important. I'm going to get to productive trees, shrubs, plants here in a minute. If you do have ornamentals, make sure that they're native species that do well through, say, drought. They don't take a lot of water. I mean, that's what makes sense. It just makes sense to do that. From a water conservation perspective. Next, and this is good for both your ornamentals and your productive trees. This is a huge, huge tip, and that's just mulching around trees and plants. Heavy mulching. This slows evaporation. It keeps moisture in the ground. It discourages weed growth. I mean, there's so much to this. It, you know, 2 to 4 inches at least of organic material of any kind of compost, whether it's wood chips or I don't care if it's straw or leaves, whatever. Put it around your bushes, your trees, your plants, and that will retain moisture like you wouldn't believe. It's a huge difference. Even if you start doing, like, say, drip irrigation, which is a great technique to save water, it soaks in all that organic material Again, it slows that evaporation, and it is great. Okay, so that now if you could do only one thing outside, that's what you would do. You'd mulch heavily around trees, plants, bushes. If you're going to use irrigation, which is perfectly fine, especially if you've established all these redundant systems, think through the type of irrigation that you want to do. You want to position your sprinklers to the max extent possible. Sometimes we got to work with whatever systems we have. And sometimes that's the best thing we can do, and then look for other ways. So again, I'm not being, you know, so rigid here as to say that you must do all these things or otherwise you're a waster. But to the max extent possible, position your sprinkler so that water lands on what you're trying to water. Okay, you'll see stuff that's like they're watering the paved, you know, driveway, you know, just as much as the lawn or whatever. And, you know, common sense things. Watering in the evening after the sun has gone down. Trying not to water on windy days where you're losing a lot of that water. Just basics. And if you can, go to something like a soaker hose or drip irrigation. That's the most efficient. I mean, you're going to use so much less water that way as opposed to your, say, Rainbird sprinklers. Water only when you need it. Okay, so get in touch with your plants, trees, shrubs, and you're watching them. You're not just saying, oh, I must water every day. You're watching it. You know, when do they need it? And if you're mulching, they won't need it as much. Okay. So you want to add that organic matter and you want to establish those efficient watering systems as much as possible. And, you know, other than those conservation techniques, the great thing about that is that it kind of ties into the best place to store water is in the soil. Okay, and I'm obviously talking about your outside. I'm talking about your productive trees, shrubs, bushes, and even your ornamentals is retaining that water in the soil. Okay, that's the best place. And again, we do that by setting up systems, by mulching heavily, by putting in swales, which are water harvesting ditches that are on contour. So it, as the water runs down into it, that water spreads out and has the ability to slow down, obviously. I mean, for example, we're on a slope. We could get heavy rains and it'll run off our property, and then within 2 days we could be dry. Okay, and that's just because it's just running off. It doesn't have a chance to soak in. So we've established lots of swales, and that allows it to slow down, and it spreads out. Okay, so water obviously runs down in the lowest areas, and it tends to congregate there, and it runs off and goes away. So what a swale does, that water harvesting ditch, is it captures that water, slows it down, spreads it out. Okay, because you've made it level, you've made it on contour. It spreads it out, so it takes it from those low areas and moves it to the higher areas. And that's a little bit of a misnomer. You're actually moving it level, but it's moving it from kind of the valleys to the ridges or draws to the fingers, depending on how you read topographic maps. Okay, so it's on contour. So you're spreading that water out, and you're allowing it ultimately to soak in. The goal there with a swale is not to create a linear pond. The goal there is to have all that water soak into the ground, and the soil holds the water. Okay, less evaporation. I mean, what's going to last longer, the water in the soil or the water in the pond? The water in the soil. Okay, the pond will evaporate over time, just like as you can imagine. Okay, so that's a very important point to this, is that we want to soak in as much as possible the water into our soil, into our land. That'll help reduce irrigation requirements, just like mulching does, things like that. So those are very important aspects of water, a water strategy on a homestead, especially. Okay, let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about wells. So when we look at wells, one of the first things that we need to think about, if we have this opportunity, is well placement. See, a lot of times, what do we do in America is we say, oh, this is where I want my house based on the view, and then I will think about the well, and I will, you know, I want the well right next to my house, so dig, you know. This is not the way we should be going about finding water. All right, what we should do is find water first and then deeply consider that for our house placement. It used to be, before probably the modern era, where all of a sudden, you know, the view and became the most important aspect of house, is that the wells oftentimes were located in the basement. I mean, you had your well in your basement, which is kind of cool. But we just don't do that anymore. So well placement, it's important. You know, if you have to dig deep wells, I mean, it's obviously going to be very expensive. Very expensive. And so that needs to be a consideration. And, you know, you have different types of well pumps. We have submersibles, which is probably the most common. You know, the submersible electric pump goes down inside the well and, you know, pumps water up via electricity. So with these wells, so you have your electric, your standard electric submersible well pump. And then there's also submersible solar pumps, which would be a great backup to your standard electric pump. And beyond that, you have hand well pumps, okay, which the technology on hand well pumps has increased greatly. I mean, to the point where now your standard well can be hand pumped from even deep, you know, depths. So, I mean, all the way down to 300 feet or maybe even a little bit more, depending on, you know, the company you're looking at. But I've been doing a lot of research into this lately because I would like a backup. I don't have a backup right now to my well pump. Now, my backup to my well pump right now is a generator. Okay, so If the power goes out, I can start the generator and I can pump water, no problem. Okay, but for me, that's not enough redundancy. I think that everybody should have at least one more method. So I say your standard electric pump and a generator, I count that as one. Some people might say, well, no, that generator is the backup. Okay, I count that as one. And then a backup to that might be, say, a solar pump. Or even better, a hand pump. And some of the, like I said, these hand well pumps can go down really deep. Now, it's all based on the static level of your well. So the static level is where does the water actually sit. It doesn't matter how deep the well is. It could be an 800-foot well, but if your static level is, say, at 75 feet, that's what you need to worry about. So you'd want to establish a system that could hand pump down to 100 feet, for example, or 200 feet, or whatever. You know, obviously, you'd want to build in a cushion there. So, for me, I want that backup. So I've got my standard submersible generator with generator. Okay, so if the grid goes down, then I can start the generator and I can pump water, but I would like another backup, if you will. So we're really looking into the hand well pump because, like I said, the technology's gotten so good in this area that there are hand well pumps that could easily pump our well. We have a static level of around 90 feet. And all the way up from anywhere from 5 to 8 gallons per minute, depending on the company and the hand pump. And it, you know, that's like one pump per second. So we're not talking about, you know, anything ridiculous here. And that's generally how they will determine, you know, how many gallons per minute. You say one pump per second. And so that's what we're looking at as a backup in that area. So for the well. All right. So I am not no expert on wells whatsoever, but these are the systems that we have available to us. And, you know, I think we should be redundant in this area. All right. So that would be what I would offer as far as wells. Make sure that your well placement is based on where water is likely, not where you want it to be. And that's also going to save you lots of money. Look for at least two systems. Okay, so one system and a backup system. If not, three. Wouldn't it be awesome to have your electric submersible? And you can do this. Your electric submersible with a generator, a backup solar submersible pump, and a hand well pump. That is a seriously resilient, redundant system. You're probably going to be just fine. Okay, so that kind of covers wells, spring development. If you are blessed with having a spring, seeps, wet areas in your area, you just might be able to develop a spring, which would be an just awesome thing. I mean, this could be a great source of water. This could provide a continuously flowing water year round. I mean, that phenomenal potential here. Even if it was low flow, even if it was say only half a gallon a minute, half a gallon a minute gets you 720 gallons a day. That is an incredible amount of water when you think about it. I mean, so much you can do with that alone, especially if this is in conjunction with all these other systems that you're setting up. So if you do have these wet area seeps, you may have a spring. And this would be a great thing to develop. It could provide drinking water for your livestock, irrigation for fields, crops, trees, you know, whatever. And if in a good area, you could then gravity feed this into other areas. And so there's so much potential here for development if you have it. When looking at property, if you're looking at property or if you have your own property and your own homestead, you know, you work with what you have. But if you are looking for property, this would be something that I would keep my eye open for. A spring could be, one, it could provide all the water you could ever need. It could be just as good as, say, in having a year-round stream on your property. And if you can develop multiple springs, man, you are blessed. We have potentially a couple springs here on this property. Now, I attempted to develop one, and it didn't work very well. Now, I think that spring will provide me water 7 months out of the year. So it's not a total failure, but it's not the best we could hope for. But developing springs, I have very little experience with this, and most of what I know is from watching YouTube channels like Engineer775, who's great at this stuff. So if you want to find an expert, go to him, watch his videos. That'll give you a really good idea, and that's exactly what I did, and was able to do it. And it's worked out well. Just like I told you, though, it wasn't the spring area. So in other words, it wasn't what I had built. It was the water there, not going to be year round for me. So again, if you can get a spring, this will reduce pressure on your well immensely, provide water for livestock, fields, orchards, food forests, whatever. Maybe even for your family, and it's certainly a great emergency source of water. Benefits. I don't even have to go there. I think it's apparent, but a clean, essentially free source of water. Pumps and electricity are usually not needed, especially if you can get a little bit of gravity feed going. And even if you can't, you could able to develop a spring, put it in a some type of trough, some type of water tank, and then you could use a very low flow pump to move that water around very inexpensively. Okay, very little electricity to move a free source of clean water around. A spring that moves year-round, that flows year-round, doesn't freeze in the winter. So that's just like, you know, a stream. A stream might freeze on the surface, but underneath it's obviously still flowing. Okay, same thing here with a spring. Potentially you could have water from more than one spot if you can develop multiple springs, or if you can even tap into that same spring from different areas. Okay, so that would be something to look at. The water from a spring, just like a well, but again, the well you obviously have to pump up with a pump, but it's cool in the summer. It's warmer in the winter, you know, because it's coming from the ground, so it's pretty consistent. And this will actually encourage your livestock to drink more water. So if you're in the heat and they're getting a constant source of fresh, cool water, they're going to drink more. This is great. It's obviously clean because it's continuously moving. And that's good. So what do you need to do? You may be able to dig it out by hand, or you may have to get a small excavator, a small backhoe. I mean, it depends on your situation. You're gonna need some gravel, some PVC pipe, and maybe a spring box, and something that you can even make yourself. Very low cost. You know, the biggest cost here is if you do have to bring in heavy equipment. Obviously, that could get pricey. But if you are able to dig it out by hand and develop it yourself, this could be a real boon for you. So what do you do? I mean, if you find a place, again, that's real wet, that's seeping water, that's flowing water. So like, you know, we have what we call a seasonal stream here, but the seasonal stream is spring fed. Now, like I said, it doesn't flow year round, hence seasonal. But I believe that we can extend that stream by developing the spring. And, you know, each year it should get better and better as we implement other strategies like drainage type swales. So in other words, we want other water flow, other catchment area to kind of channel it a little bit into this spring, help recharge that spring fed source. And I think we can, over time, extend that period, you know, where we have flowing water. So you're going to dig into the area, into the hillside. In a lot of cases, that's where you're going to find them. To find that source of the spring or the seep, you're going to, like I said, develop that area. You're going to want to put a lot of gravel there and piping. So you're going to provide almost a miniature dam. A small dam area where water can kind of build up and collect, and you're going to want to fill that with gravel. Okay, so think of PVC pipe with holes drilled into it behind some kind of makeshift dam, all filled in with gravel. So water is going to seep in there and collect into the PVC pipe, the perforated pipe, and then go through that pipe. All right, makes sense. Pretty simple. And the reason you want to do that, reason you want to cover it all up, is to keep any type of surface contaminants. Maybe there's, you know, of course, wildlife. You know, you don't want to get your feces or anything like that in there. You don't want to get small animals to go in there and either nest or use it as a source of water and perhaps die in there and provide major problems as far as clean water is concerned. So hence, you do that. Now, if you watch Engineer 775's videos, he'll do things. He'll backfill it with the gravel. He'll cover that area with plastic and then put earth over the top of it. So it's really well sealed in there and kept clean. So that's an excellent way to do it. What I did is I developed the spring, put in the dam, had the perforated PVC, filled it all in with gravel, and then I just put earth over the top of it. Okay, and I think that's a perfectly fine way to do it as well. But if you wanted to put a plastic layer in there, that would be good. Now, that's as far as I went. So then water flows out of that pipe out of the other side of the spring. Now, what most people do is then run that water from that pipe so it's only had that initial gravel as a filter, and then it goes through the perforation in the PVC. So you can sense it's a bit of a natural filter, but there's still stuff kind of running through there. So what most people do then is run that pipe to a spring box. And then what that spring box is essentially provides another filter. So the dirt and the sand goes down to the bottom of the spring box, and then the cleaner water flows from the spring box. Okay, so then you just have a little bit of maintenance with that spring box, cleaning it out, I don't know, a couple times a year. Now, from there, you can run that spring, so from the spring box or the pipe, run it to a water collection tank of whatever. I don't care if it's a large tank, it could be barrels, it could just be a trough, an open trough for cattle, and with it with an overflow, you know, whatever. What I want to do is run it to the totes, 275 gallon totes. And then on to some other, so I might put multiple totes there, or so I want to be able to use it in different ways. I want to be able to either use it for irrigation, to fill up swales, to water animals, etc. So multiple functions. That would be ideal. And then once you are able to kind of develop that, you could end up having literally a continuous source of water that runs year round, which would be phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. So I used the example earlier of half a gallon per minute, which would be a low flow spring. I mean, most springs that you're able to develop will do more than that. So like when our spring is running, we probably get closer to 2 gallons per minute. All right. So, I mean, that's like over 2,500 gallons per day. Well over that, if we're getting, you know, 2 gallons per minute. But even with the example of a low flow spring of half a gallon per minute, that's 720 gallons per day. Just for an example, that can provide drinking water for 10 or more beef cows. I mean, that's significant. And obviously, you know, with just your well, with just your submersible pump, you're not going to want to provide all the water for your own house, provide all the water for irrigation for your crops, and provide all the water for your animals. That's too much on a well. Okay, that's why most farmers don't do that. They have other sources of irrigation. So they're fairly easy to maintain, especially if you can develop it yourself. It's really not that hard. You got to do a little bit of maintenance. You're going to be checking for leaks in the pipes and the spring box and just taking a look at it, probably cleaning out that spring box twice a year, maybe 3 times a year. But that's it. If you can, if you're able to develop a spring, I would highly recommend it. That would be awesome. We're hoping to do more of that here. All right, so we talked about wells, we talked about springs. The next thing that I want to talk about is rainwater collection. Now, this is a huge topic area in itself, and we could do an entire podcast based on this alone. I definitely want to find an expert in this area and bring someone in for an interview. But I want to cover some basics when it comes to rainwater collection, and I like to start out with very simple examples because that's the way I think. And just to show you kind of the potential that you can achieve. So let's say that you set up rainwater collection. Everybody kind of understands this on a basic level, where you set up a system, you've got barrels or cisterns, whatever you have, and you're collecting off of a roof, which is kind of the standard way of collecting rainwater. And if you manage to collect rainwater off 2,000 square feet, okay, 2,000 feet, so 100 by 20 or however you want to work that out. Doesn't really matter. What we're talking about is catchment area or the roof footprint. For every inch of rain, based on those calculations, you can get 1,250 gallons of water. That's a lot of water for every inch of rain. So if you're in an area that has 30 inches of rain annually, that is equivalent to 37,500 gallons of water that you simply collected for free. Now, that doesn't count setting up the system, which can be pricey, but there are ways to get around that. 37,500 gallons of water, catching rainwater. And that's in an area that's below average for the United States, but a decent amount of rain. Okay, that's our average annual rainfall here, and we're working towards setting that up. I've calculated that we have right now we're able to catch off of about 1,500 square feet, and we're going to easily double that. Okay, easily, if not triple that, eventually. So as you can see, it's exponential. We should be able to get to a point where we're collecting 50,000 gallons of water a year. All right, so some considerations for catching rainwater. Obviously, this is a great system for redundancy purposes. So we've got your well, you're working on springs, you've got swells set up to help collect water and then store it in the soil. You're using mulching systems, and then you want to set up rainwater systems. I mean, this is great. This we're starting to get to a level of redundancy that's very comfortable. You want to think about your roof material. So we talked about catchment area, and generally speaking, it's roofs. So off your outbuildings, your barn, your house, your woodshed, doesn't matter. I mean, everything should have some rainwater catchment on it, especially if you've got an intended purpose for it. So for example, we have a system set up on our barn. Now we're only catching a little bit better than half of the roof at this point, but we're going to expand it. We're going to be able to catch off the entire roof very soon. But the purpose of that water there is to water our animals. Okay, so to provide water directly to the troughs. And that works out well. And we'll hopefully get to a point where we're able to catch more and we can expand that system. But for now, we only have one tote down there, so it can collect up to 275 gallons at a time. That's not a whole lot, and so we're hoping to at least double that, okay, if not triple that. But one of the considerations for this is the roof material, and it has to do with contaminants. And so, you have to watch that. What type of contaminants are you going to find on the roofs of your house, both in the material of the roof and then the contaminants that end up on the roof. For our area, obviously we have birds like everywhere else that will drop feces onto the roof on occasion. One thing we don't have is a lot of deciduous trees, okay, besides our productive trees but that aren't really around our roofs. So our coniferous trees, besides the larch, but we don't have any larch that's close to our roofs once again. So we don't have a lot of excess material. We don't have a lot of leaves and things like that. But feces is obviously a factor for us. But so those are considerations. Roofing material, the material itself, is important. Most of your asphalt shingles are fine for collection. The best is probably your metal roofs. One for a couple different reasons. One, there's less chemicals and stuff that are used that say an asphalt shingle initially will have some contaminants. You'll want to flush. If you have a brand new asphalt shingle roof, I would want to flush a lot of that first before I started using it. I would use it in a gray water manner for a while at first. So put it in swales, put it in, you know, on your trees, etc., for a while before I started using it for, say, animals and, you know, your more like annual type gardens. But the other reason why metal works so well is that it sheds the water quickly, which means it also sheds the contaminants quickly. So bird poop, for example, it sheds it very quickly. And that also has to do with the slope. So the slope of your roof is a factor. So in our area, which, you know, is more steep roofs due to snow load, sheds water faster and therefore sheds contaminants faster, as opposed to a less steep, flatter roof that will slow the water down and therefore the contamination will last a little bit longer. So there, you might want to put in a few more checks in that kind of a situation. Now, a lot of people are extremely concerned with filtration on rainwater, which I get. That's important. And so there's all kinds of different systems for filtering rainwater. Here's what's called a first flush system, rain washers, and they're all kind of the same thing. They're just manners of getting rid of the contaminants. That's the goal. The requirement is get rid of the contaminants, not so much, you know, the specific system you use to do that. But there's lots of videos online that you can figure out how to do that. We have used a filtration system where we have several inline filters, okay, and they're just your very tightly spaced wire, basically. All right, so for filtering systems, depending on what the use and functions of that system are, because we have two different water catchment systems, and we will eventually have even more. Okay, just the way everything is designed here. And depending on the uses of those systems will determine whether or not we use the type of rain washer or the type of first flush system that we use. In the areas where it's very simple for us to clean out, we can put just different wire filters in different areas to remove the contaminants. Okay, so we have roof material, slope, and then we talked a little bit about sizing. I don't want to go into detail. Find a calculator online. But again, if you just use the simple, if you remember that 2,000 square feet, 1 inch of rain gets you 1,250 gallons, it's simple to just interpolate that. So 1,000 is 625, you know, for every inch of rain, etc. And then you can go up or down from there just to get a general idea of what type of catchment you can get from rain. So that's an important aspect of rainwater collection. Here's another one. Keeping the water clean, we talked about the filters and the first flush, rain washing, or roof washers. The tank itself, so your collection device itself, we have those totes that you can find pretty inexpensively, and it's important that you understand what they were used for. We don't use anything that was used, you know, for chemicals, things like that. If they were food grade, basically, then we'll buy them used and use them. However, they're always white, and that means sunlight can get in. That means algae growth All right. So one of the things that we're doing here very soon is we're going to paint our tanks black. Okay. And that's to stop the sun from getting in and to get rid of the algae growth. All right. So you have to think about that as well. If you have white tanks or light colored tanks where sun can filter in, you're going to be fighting algae and growth. So that's one thing we haven't done yet, and we're going to do soon. But if you look and look for these tanks used, you can find some great deals out there. Buying water tanks new it's very expensive. It's usually you're going to find, basically a dollar a gallon. So a 500 gallon tank might cost you $500. Of course, that's a generalization. But if you're buying new, that's how much it generally will cost. If you go lower, in other words, if you go down, say 100 gallon or 200 gallon, it's usually going to be more per gallon. And if you go up, it's usually going to be a little bit less than a dollar per gallon. Okay, it's a general rule of thumb. So it's expensive. So you need to get creative and look for other ways to find your water bells, if you can find them used. Even simple, people use these 55 gallon barrels. That's fine too. I mean, if you have those, if you have a barrel like that on every downspout of your house, yeah, that adds up, and you're gonna be able to use that. You also want to think through gravity as much as possible. So getting your barrel off the ground as much as you can, so you can use it. If it's just sitting on the ground, that's great, but you may be limited in what you can do with that. Now, you may be able to fashion a hose to it, and enough, if it's full, you have enough pressure there to do some things, but once it starts getting down, you start losing pressure. Therefore, if you can raise those things up as much as possible, do so. Watch the weight load, think that through. So we have one of the tanks we have a 500 gallon tank. If you just use an average of 8 gallons or 8 pounds per gallon of water, I mean, that's 4,000 pounds. Okay. That's a lot of weight. And so you have to be careful on how you build, whether you're going to build a platform, if you're going to use concrete block or wood or whatever, you have to build something that's strong enough to hold what that maximum weight could be, and make sure that it's nice and level and not going to be a safety issue for someone. You don't want kids or animals playing underneath a tank that has so much weight in it. Okay, so those are some considerations as far as rainwater collection. My goal for today was to give you a bunch of overall strategies that you can use to implement. So the principle here is that you have redundant water systems in place so that your property, your family is resilient. And so that if you do lose something or whatever, it's not the end of the world. Okay, if you lose your well for whatever reason, that you can continue. It may not be easy, but that you can. In my ideal world, I'd have a well and it would have three means of being able to pump out of it. I'd have some springs that were able to flow year round, and I have a system of swales that help hydrate the soil. I've got rainwater collection. That's an excellent, and it might even be overkill. Some combinations thereof is what you should be looking for. We have a smattering of all of those things, but not all of those things are very well producing. So in other words, our spring, which doesn't flow year round, our rainwater collection is not where I want it to be right now. We don't have redundant systems on our well. We do have an annual stream. So if all bets are off, we can always get water from there. But we wouldn't want to be, with the amount of animals we have, we wouldn't be carrying 5 gallon buckets of water over distance very much. Okay, so some things to think about, some water strategies to consider. Always shoot for a redundant system so that you and your family, your homestead, can be very resilient. Our scripture for today comes from John chapter 7, verses 37 through 39. On the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." Now this he said about the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive, for as yet the Spirit had not been given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.